history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are untold stories right there around you that really should not remain untold. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always find that we learn so much. We're educated, we're also entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The final year of World War II was so eventful around the globe, and if you've been paying attention lately, you've been hearing about it because of the timing. 75th anniversaries of milestone moments have been happening left and right, and there are some significant ones to come between now and next August. Every engagement at sea, on land, or in the air during that immense worldwide conflict provides another layer for that big picture. And if we zoom in even further, as we typically do on this show, we see how individuals experience these world-changing moments, which of course would become life-changing moments for them. Frequently, in the midst of tragic circumstances, we find stories that give us hope, stories of survival, of dodging death, of resilience, perseverance, and victory. 75 years ago this week, the world was, of course, inflamed in catastrophe. Families in every corner of America had blue stars hanging in the window, hoping they would not receive the devastating news that would turn a blue star to gold. Half a world away, in the Philippine Sea, a massive assemblage of American firepower was taking aim at Japanese installations on Taiwan, known then as Formosa. 17 American aircraft carriers, 6 battleships, 4 heavy cruisers, 11 light cruisers, and nearly 60 destroyers were all in that vicinity as part of Task Force 38. A typhoon had just moved through the area, so seas were still pretty rough, and the opposition was rougher. Japanese planes relentlessly attacked the fleet, and nearly 90 American aircraft were lost, but out of all those ships I listed, almost 100 of them, only 2 suffered heavy damage in that 5-day battle, and none of them went under, which is pretty remarkable. We're going to focus today on the story of one ship, the USS Houston, and eventually one man aboard that ship. But first, I think we need to provide some context. In today's Navy, there's a submarine named the USS Houston. In World War I, there was a cargo ship with that name. But in World War II, there were 2 ships named the Houston, both cruisers. The first one fought successfully in the Battle of the Java Sea in February 1942, which was, to that point, the largest surface engagement of the war. Just days later, though, while sailing in the Sunda Strait in Indonesia, which the Navy believed was clear of enemy vessels, the Houston was struck after midnight by 1 torpedo, then slammed again by 3 more in succession. It sank quickly in the middle of the night, so in the perspective of the rest of the Navy at the time, it just disappeared. It became known as the Galloping Ghost of the Java Coast. The full story wouldn't be told until after World War II ended 3.5 years later, when surviving prisoners of war explained that about a third of the crew, 368 men, had survived and been captured by the Japanese, but the rest, nearly 700, were killed that fateful night. This was less than 4 months into America's involvement in World War II, and as far as anyone knew, a 1,000 American sailors had just vanished. So how do you respond to such a devastating situation? Well, at the end of May 1942, 1,000 new sailors were sworn in Houston, Texas, labeled the Houston Volunteers, ostensibly replacing the men lost on that still unaccounted-for ship. In October of that year, a cruiser called the Vicksburg was renamed in honor of the missing ship, with President Franklin D. Roosevelt saying, quote, "Our enemies have given us the chance to prove that there will be another USS Houston, and yet another USS Houston if that becomes necessary, and still another USS Houston as long as American ideals are in jeopardy." That second cruiser, Houston, wouldn't see action until 1944. And 75 years ago this week, in that Battle of Formosa, it nearly suffered the same fate as its namesake. The pattern of that battle had Americans launching air raids against Japanese installations on Formosa during the day, with the enemy targeting American warships at night. On the night of October 14th, 4 torpedo planes took aim at the Houston, and one of them snuck through to land a direct hit to the engine room, resulting in a loss of propulsive power. In a bit, minute, we're going to hear the memory of a man who was actually steering the ship in that moment and find out how he experienced it. But first, some background on just how remarkable it is that the Houston survived that blow and another torpedo strike that would occur two nights later. Let's listen to a recording made way back in 1971 by the U.S. Naval Institute's Oral History Program. I have their website linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. This is Rear Admiral George Miller, who, when this attack occurred, was a damage control officer aboard the Houston.
The great majority of the people on board the ship were in a state of shock, and the ship was helpless. Everything was dead, the engines. We had no power to our gun. Lying to, listing, deep in the water, decks awash, starboard deck awash. The ship was literally helpless. It was a liability to the commander of the task force at the time. We were 75 miles off Formosa, less than 70 miles perhaps. The Japanese were still attacking. The Bettys were everywhere. We could see them. They came in low. They came past us. I believe they fired a couple torpedoes at us after the first one hit. The task force commander wanted to get out of there and make some distance between, put some distance between himself and the position where he was in by daylight. I was down in damage control, of course, when the Houston was hit, and I went through my routine testing. My people down there tested all stations and soon realized that after boiler room and engine and the forward engine room flooded immediately, that the forward fire room was flooding rapidly and had to be abandoned, and that the after engine was also flooding, could not be controlled. So I then ordered the damage control efforts to confining the flooding within the boundaries of the engineering, main engineering space of the forward compartment. As reports began to come in, I found that the third deck above the after fire room and forward engine room, the armor plate had been breached and that the second deck was flooding. I then ordered them to confine the flooding in the second deck, the spaces directly above the after fire room and the forward. Now I had, I realized, a quick calculation, more water on board, probably more water on board, at least as much water on board as the battleship Deerfing in World War I. More water on board in comparison with our displacement than any other ship that survived in World War II.
I realize some of it may be hard to hear. This recording was made nearly 50 years ago, but I wanted to draw attention to that last statement, that the Houston had more water on board in comparison to its displacement than any other ship that survived World War II. That alone tells you how close it was to capsizing. Remember, this is all unfolding in the dark of the night as well, and over 1,200 men aboard are trying to figure out what the future might hold for them.
I was unable to reach the bridge. They were busy with other things. So that when I had given all the instructions about confining the bounds of floodwater, I left, crew and I left the damage control, and I ordered the crew out of the main fire control, which was adjacent to us, and up to the second deck, and advised my people. Damage control was shifting to the forward station, the second deck. When I got to the second deck, I learned by word of mouth that we'd been given orders to abandon ship. Found at that time that ship, including the bridge, were all in the process of preparing to abandon and to abandon ship. I seemed to be able to have very little help in working the damage control problem. I was able to identify a very few key people, and I'll name them. It's Julius Stuckert, a lieutenant, a phlegmatic, introverted lieutenant, who was my damage control assistant. He says, "What do you want me to do, boss?" I sent Joe Simpson and Carpenter Schnabel to the after part of the ship to check on the flooding boundaries, to ensure that they were holding, and to begin shoring the second deck in the area where it had been breached, because the second deck was now flooding rapidly, and that was the center of the ship, and that the forward and after bulkheads, flooded area, were bulging. So I asked that they be shored and that the flooding boundaries be watched for any evidence of extended flooding. I told Charlie York and Julius Stuckert to go forward and prepare for towing. I then went to the bridge to report to the captain what I had done, and the captain brushed me aside and said, "George, we're in order to abandon ship." I then went to the after part of the bridge and talked to the executive officer, and I said, I'm not going to abandon ship. I said, I think this ship can be saved. I want to stay. And he listened for a while, and he said, all right, let's go back to the captain. Back we went. The captain kept asking me if I was sure the ship could survive for the night. And I said, no, I'm not sure, but I think it's worth a try. With a little luck, it will survive. And this discussion went on for quite some time. And when the captain understood my feeling about abandoning the ship, that I was going to stay, he then said, all right, and he went back to the task force commander, and I said, we must have a tow. He said, all right, go down and prepare for towing, and I'll try to get someone to tow it. And so I went down to the forecastle. Meanwhile, destroyers were coming alongside, and while the ship was rolling heavily, people were going into, the crew was going into the water. They were abandoning ship. In our efforts to prepare for a tow, we had very little help from those who were in charge of forward decks, those who were in charge of the forepart of the ship. It was very dark, the ship was rolling very heavily. Occasionally, the starboard side of the deck would receive a large wave, and it would work its way down onto the second deck. So that as we continually had the problem of keeping the watertight doors of the main deck secured, because flooding was still continuing. Before I left damage control, it looked to me like the ship would capsize. Now, as I recall, we had calculated that if the ship rolled more than, I believe, 37 and a half degrees, with the kind of water we had aboard that would go over, I believe that our maximum roll did indeed reach 37 and a half degrees to starboard, and the ship did capsize. But the problem was that as long as you had your big engine compartments partially flooded, you had what you call free surface. Free surface gives you a dangerous stability situation. As I watched the roll, I noticed that as she settled deeper in the water and the big compartments filled to the top, that the roll subsided somewhat. Before I left the damage control, I felt that at least the ship would not capsize. The other thing, as the ship settled, the big longitudinals were beginning to buckle because of the weight. The buoyancy was in the bow of the stern. Before I reported the bridge, we had to appraise that. It was very dangerous to go and look at these longitudes because rivets were flying at the speed of bullets. They were flying throughout the area, and it looked like, literally, the ship was going to break in half. It looked to me at first, the keel itself had been severed.
So that gives you a picture of how close the Houston was to going under, how miraculous it may be that it did not. Things didn't look so good for the light cruiser USS Houston 75 years ago this week, did they? That was George H. Miller, damage control officer aboard the Houston that day, who would go on to become an admiral, thanks to the U.S. Naval Institute's oral history program for that decades-old audio. And now let's dig into a much more recent interview with a man who was aboard that day. Jonas Hofer passed away a couple years ago at the age of 93. In 2014, he shared his remarkable story here on Hometown Heroes. He was a teenaged member of the ship's original crew.
My duties was working with the navigation department. I was a bugle master, so I had five buglers, but I didn't have to get up early in the morning to do it. The five would do that. And then I was in the navigation branch. There's 13 of us in there, and I would steer the ship 1 hour out of four when I was on duty. So I was a helmsman. Actually, I was at the helms when the first torpedo hit, and the ship just raised out of the water and dropped. And I had a helmet on, and my helmet got jammed down on my head.
Let's set the scene for this. So you're taking your turn at the helm, and people hear torpedo, they assume that's a submarine, but these were actually planes, torpedo bomber planes that were coming. Did you have any idea they were in the area?
We had 40 of them in the air that time, and in fact, after our ship was torpedoed and I was in the water and the battle was still going, oh no, I was still aboard ship, I counted 13 airplanes burning in the water at one time. And maybe 10 of them were Japanese and maybe 3 of them were in that there. So it was, if you've ever been in a battle like that, there's smoke and noise and of course your own ship get hit. It's terrible. You can't, but you do what you have to do. You know, you don't panic. You keep on working at that, hoping it won't hit you.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it was like to be in your shoes, because here
What are you, 19, 20 years old at that point?
I was 18, yeah. I was 18 when I was a survivor. But I remember then we were going and airplanes were going over the ships and dropping torpedoes and that. And a torpedo came toward us and the captain saw it. So the captain says, right 30 degrees rudder, which is white over. So I spun the wheel over it, and it was coming in like this, and we were turning in at it, but we didn't get soon enough. It was too close. This airplane had come over another ship and then was between us, so they couldn't fire at him about 20 feet off the water, and then we couldn't fire at him, and he dropped the fish, and then he went off, and we shot him down. But it was too late then.
So you turned into the path of the torpedo.
Right, yeah. There had been a typhoon through there 2 days before, so the ship was rolling quite then. So the torpedo broke the ship's keel. In the ship there is a keel that's about 10 feet high, maybe 12 inches of steel, both like an I-beam, goes the whole length of the ship. That was broken. So the ship was like that there. So the captain, we thought the ship was going to break in half. So the captain said to check with all the other officers. An hour later, he says, abandon ship. Well, I was waiting and didn't get off right away. I was me and the other guy, Dwight, who had this navigator's Bible study. We were together waiting, and the guys were jumping off the side, and the boats were all going off and that. When an hour later, the captain, one of the officers told him, maybe we can save the ship. So the captain reversed his abandoned ship. But by that time, we had 1,000 guys leave already. So there was maybe 250. I have a picture of it here.
So it was a pretty skeleton crew on a wounded ship.
The ship, the bottom was, of course, there were probably 40, 50 guys in the engineering were all killed right off bat. Because they were underwater and that there. And the ship was down so far in the water and that there that we had no food. So the Phoenix, another cruiser, came by and gave us sandwiches. And that's what this is. We're eating the first time that day.
So this is a photograph while the Houston is still afloat. It's been torpedoed once. And you're still on board. And you're saying, okay, time to eat lunch.
Yes. And what happened then, a seagoing tug came out and hooked onto us and started pulling us away from Formosa toward Ulithi.
And we're going to leave things right there as we grab our first commercial break. We've got some photos relating to this episode posted at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. 75 years ago this week, the USS Houston crippled by that torpedo attack. It was about to be struck again. And we'll hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.